Good evening, and welcome to What a World. Celebrating diversity and loving it, this is Nevin Campanella bringing you a radio talk show that has no limits and bows to no one. From this microphone, we bring you guests who will lead you across those shadowy plains of forbidden knowledge. And tonight's forbidden knowledge will be brought to us by Patrick Cook, a researcher of the Christian Bible and its clues to how mankind became established on the planet Earth. Truly a walk into a shadowy realm that has many claiming to know the truth regarding our existence. And there is another kind of truth out there. It has to do with the truth about Earth changes and how our physical bodies react to those changes. And now, Charlotte King will update us on physical symptoms as they relate to earthquakes and volcanic eruptions. Hi, Charlotte. What do you have for us tonight?
Well, hi, Nevin. It's been kind of a quiet week seismically. We've had some earthquakes, obviously, but there's not been anything of any major size that has picked up anywhere in the world this last week. The largest, I believe, was a 6.2 in the Bismarck Sea, which isn't too far from Papua New Guinea and that area. Mostly this week, people are complaining of headaches. Some of them are migraine. Some of them are just a really miserable headache. Of course, some of these could be flu-related, but most of them, I believe, are earth-related. The back ahead is always volcanic, and it's usually on the left side if it's the Cascades. If it's on the right side, it can be Alaska or the Philippines or Indonesia or Hawaii or those other areas. Then we have the temple-to-temple headache, which is generally Northern California, Eureka to the Bay. And we have the center of forehead headache, which is usually Southern California into Mexico. And there has been some of that again this week, and that is also conjoined with heart pain, mostly of the sharp needle type variety, and that's definitely Southern California into Mexico and Mexico proper. Then we're getting a lot of stomach pain again, reported. That's the Sierras again. That was especially bad on Wednesday and Thursday of this week. I actually came home from work with stomach pains. For that, I would recommend having very, very hot and very, very sweet peppermint tea, and that will really ease that pain a lot. There's been some, left earaches again. Again, we're looking at China, Pakistan, Afghanistan, and the area of India, Nicobar Islands. The right ear has been acting up off and on, and, of course, that's looking at Taiwan and the Leeward, Windward, and Trinidad Islands, and those are due for aftershocks from the ones they had a couple weeks ago. The geysers in California are stirring again, and each time the geysers really build up pressure and start having a lot of geothermal activity, that usually signals that there's going to be another quake over 3 or 3.5 or greater in California in a very short time. The more activity there is in the geysers, the more activity there will be elsewhere in California, at least my experience.
Are you expecting something to occur in California at this point, Charlotte?
Only in the point of a felt event, possibly down in Southern Cal again, down around El Centro, Mexicali, Calexico, out in the desert area, into Mexico out there, that area. There's been a lot of vertigo, and the eyes are bothering people again. That's always an Oregon symptom. Oregon only actually causes the eyes that you can see fine, but you just can't focus. And that's always Oregon. And that's been really active again. We're having a lot of pets killed on the roads again. People are disoriented. People are not paying attention. We're having the birds flying almost into the cars last Friday. Might be weather related, but basically, things are, you know, relatively okay. There's been some rib pain on the left side. That's Australia, New Zealand, Papua New Guinea, Kermadec Islands. I am expecting something, and I can't tell you what it is because I don't know. But I do know that what I'm feeling is not good. And when and if that comes to fruition, as far as my symptoms putting it together, I will post it on my blog right away on my website, which is www.visor.net/tilde/sharking/
Okay. Also, folks, you can get to Charlotte's website from waterworld.com. There's a link at the very top of the page. It says earthquake alert, and that will bring you right to her website. Is that it for tonight, Charlotte?
That's it for tonight.
Thank you so much. And
I appreciate
it. We'll hear from you tomorrow. Oh,
okay.
You're more than welcome, Charlotte. Thank you so much.
You
bet.
Bye-bye.
Also, folks, we do have a toll-free number to take calls. And we are going to take calls tonight, probably beginning around a quarter to 11. The phone number is 1-888-268-4313. Today is November 6th. What happened in history? Well, in 1860, Abraham Lincoln was elected on November 6th, obviously, election day, right? Guess what, folks? The following year, 1861, Jefferson Davis was elected president. One of my most favorite, John Philip Sousa. Can't you have him? John Philip Sousa, everybody recognizes his music on this date. In 1991, one of my very most favorite actresses, Jean Tierney, who was born in 1920. Now, some of you will remember the TV show, The Ghost and Mrs. Muir. Well, it was Jean Tierney who first played that role in the movie The Ghost and Mrs. Muir in 1947. Let me tell you, folks, this woman is absolutely stunning. If you want to take a look at what she looks like, you can go to my website and at waterworld.com, on the menu, place the mouse over Potpourri, then click on Reflections, and you'll see a picture. I'm being told that Skype is cutting out badly, so hold on for a few seconds and let me check with the station manager to see what we need to do. Hang in there, folks. Well, he says it's getting better now. Sometimes we do get a bad connection, and I think we're okay. Now, current news. Well, most of you are aware that arsonists torched over 1,300 cars so far around the suburbs of Paris. 300 people have been arrested. And how did it start? Well, apparently there were two children who were electrocuted. How they got electrocuted, I'm not really sure. But this seemed to start an entire 11 nights of violence. I also need to make a correction, not whataworld.com, it's whataworldradio.com. Sorry, folks. Thank goodness we have Don Newsom standing there in the background correcting your talk show host. Thank you, Don. And CNN reporting that more than 20 people so far are dead from that tragic tornado that tore through southwestern Indiana. Over 200 people injured. I watched some films of this on CNN, and you know what, folks? That tornado made that entire area look like a bunch of matchsticks. Well, the onslaught of natural disasters on this planet since the tsunami in Southeast Asia last December seems of almost biblical proportions. Are we on the verge of apocalyptic disasters? I'm not sure. Tonight's guest, Patrick Cook, may be able to uncover some of these mysteries for us. Patrick states on his website, quote, that mankind and the planet's biosphere are the products of technologically advanced beings, and that organized religion has purposely been deceiving humanity from the outset regarding the truth and what it portends for the future. He has written a book on the subject titled The Greatest Deception. The book uncovers the deceptions foisted upon humankind by the religious dogmatists. Hi, Patrick. Welcome to What a World.
Thank you for having
me. How are you doing?
Yourself.
Oh, we're really happy to have you here, Patrick.
It's very interesting that you let. It's very interesting that you let out with that kind of news, because it certainly looks like we are in apocalyptic times.
Oh, it most certainly does. And, you know, I mean, it's like one disaster after the other. They just keep coming and coming and coming. And as a matter of fact, I heard on the news a politician out of Washington saying the same thing. When he was talking about the FEMA response, he started saying they just don't stop. You know, the disasters keep rolling along. Well, Patrick, your website is a clearinghouse of information on the subject of UFOs, but it does not have a lot on you, the researcher. So before we get started, how about sharing with us a little of your background? Who are you, and how did you become involved in this type of subject?
Well, it's very interesting. I started out at a very young age in fundamentalist religion. I was trained to be a minister from a very young age, and eventually left the church over doctrinal issues. Mainly, I had problems with the canons of the church and the scriptural basis for those canons. So I left the church, and that was at about the age of 17. And for the next 30 years or so, I began to unlearn everything that I'd ever been taught and relearn everything from my own personal research. And it has resulted in what you see online now, which is the Bible UFO Connection. That's www.bibleufo.com. And it's a collection of the research that I've done over the last 30 years. And it engages a number of issues concerning UFOs, their presence in the Bible, and other things relating to the beings that are piloting those vessels.
So if a person wants to get a hold of your book, The Greatest Deceptions, how would they go about it, Patrick?
Well, it's available on Amazon.com, and you just look for The Greatest Deception, The Bible UFO Connection. And I have other books, and you just click on my name when you get to that book, and you'll see the other books that I have available, which are The Doctrines of Men, which outline the doctrines as they're practiced by the church now and their scriptural basis. And I have an interesting book about the lost books of the Bible, the Apocrypha, which are the 15 books that were removed from the Bible. I go into detail about that, and actually publish the books themselves. So
the books removed from the Bible. Are you referring to the this meeting that took place AD something or other somewhere in the Middle East?
The Council of Nicaea.
I think it was in Constantinople.
Well, Constantinople. There are a lot of rumors that go around about how these books were removed. The books that I'm talking about, the Apocrypha, were actually published in the King James Bible in 1611, and they continued into the Bible until 1885. It's actually 15 books. It's about 150,000 words, which makes up about 20% of the Bible was removed in 1885.
It was removed in 1885?
In 1885. It's a surprising thing. We have searched and searched and searched to try to figure out exactly what happened. And as hard as it may be to believe, the books of the Apocrypha were always controversial within the church, but they were absolutely published in almost all of the older Bibles will have them. They were originally published when King James published the King James Bible, and they continued that way until 1885. What we believe happened, surprisingly enough, is that there was a paper shortage in the late 1800s, and they may have been eliminated because of that and never put back into the Bible.
Wow. So for lack of a horse, the kingdom was lost for lack of a piece of paper.
Absolutely.
People are going down
shock.
A dark trail. Oh, that's awful.
Right, but it's really surprising that only maybe 1 out of 1,000 theologians even knows that the Apocrypha were actually included in the King James Bible originally. And there are a number of others that are associated with it.
You're certainly giving me new information. I had assumed all along that most of those things were removed, a few hundred years ago. You're talking about 1885.
That's only those 15 books. Now, what most people don't realize is that the Old Testament that we have now was actually put together by a man named Eusebius, who was a member of the court of the Emperor Constantine, and he was commissioned by Constantine to produce a Bible. And from that, he came up with the original 39 books we have in the Old Testament of the Bible. So that's pretty solid. And as a matter of fact, that original Bible has been put online recently. I'm sorry, I don't know exactly where it is, but it has been put online recently. And then the New Testament that we have was produced after those books were put together. So what we have, there were a lot of controversies about which books of the New Testament went in. Now, the Apocrypha books that I was talking about were actually part of the Old Testament, not the New Testament. The New Testament was put together, and there was a lot of debate on which books should be put in. As a, for instance, there was a very close vote that we almost had, instead of the revelation of John, we almost had the revelation of Peter. And it's absolutely fascinating the way it was put together. But generally, the books that are in there now are pretty much vetted as being genuine. There are a lot of controversies, a lot of different theories about how the New Testament was put together. But I think that it's sufficient as it stands, even though there are a lot of other books that need to be brought to attention that give light to a lot of things that the Bible is not too terribly clear on. The Book of Enoch,
Patrick,
is one in particular.
I want to bring you to a statement you make on your website, quote, "Hiding behind opulent facades and benevolent imagery, the church is shown in its true form, that of the oppressor, not the origin of truth." Now, what I want to ask you is, what church are you referring to, and can you give us some examples?
Well, the church that we refer to, the origin of that church was the Emperor Constantine. He came to power in 312 A.D. His mother, Helen, had a pseudo-Christian concept. Most people do not. My website clearly shows what the original church was, and it was nothing of the form that we see now. But Constantine's mother was a pseudo-Christian. As a matter of fact, she established the first churches, which were actually resorts for visiting dignitaries. And they changed their use over time. But Constantine decided that he was going to join the pagan religions of Rome with Christianity. Up until that time, now we've heard about the terrible things that happened in the Colosseum with Christians. The immediate predecessor to Constantine was the emperor that performed those horrid things.
But you mean like beating Christians to the lions?
Beating Christians to the lion, literally. And so he changed that and decided that it was expedient politically for him. They could not, no matter what they tried to do, they could not wipe out the Christian religion. So what Constantine decided to do was declare himself the head of the church. He combined the pagan religions that were prevalent in Rome and the Christian religion, put them all together in a blender, sort of, and put it on high speed and poured it into a glass, and then he had Christianity. But what he did was he decided that he would not allow anything that was Judaic. He had something, he perhaps is one of the first anti-Jews in history. He declared that everything that was Judaic in the Bible should be removed, as for instance, the Sabbath. Now, the Sabbath in the Bible states that you rest on Saturday. Well, he decided to outlaw resting on Saturday. You absolutely had to work on Saturday, but you would worship God on Sunday, on the first day of the week rather than the seventh day of the week, because he wanted to completely eliminate any recognition of any Judaic law. So now what we've come up with is all these things were established around his time. And they were just verified and added to as the church moved on. It was called the Universal Church, which became the Catholic Church. Now, the Catholic Church had a split in the 1600s when the King James Bible was written and the Church of England decided to break off. Henry VIII was part of that. They decided to break off and they became Protestants. But actually, if you compare the beliefs of the Protestant Church and the Catholic Church, you're going to find that they are 98% similar. It's,
oh yes,
what you
absolutely
see is a Protestant is nothing more than a protesting Catholic. and they follow almost all of the laws, and all of those, all of the original law, all of the rules, all of the teachings, the doctrines that you see in the church today were established in the 4th century by Constantine, and they are an anathema to what is actually in the Bible. And I detail that very clearly on my website, BibleUFO.com, under the doctrines of men. And I show how the church...
Patrick, give the audience a clear sentence as to what the stimulus was for the Protestant church to occur. In other words, what one or two incidents occurred to remove themselves from the Vatican?
The divine right of kings is the reason. The crown felt itself inferior, or felt that the church at Rome considered the crown inferior. So what they decided to do was to change certain things within the Bible. It's a very complicated way they did it. But the divine right of kings is a very interesting concept. It means that if everything is good in the kingdom, God has blessed the king, and that he's a good king. And if anything goes wrong in the kingdom, all the people are bad, and it doesn't have anything to do with the king. It's a very complicated thing, but they...
When things are good, the king gets the credit. When things are bad, the people get the credit.
That's right. Absolutely. And also there was another minor situation, there was a Geneva Bible that was being used, and King James did not like what was written in the Geneva. It's a very interesting study about King James. If you go in and study the kind of man he was, it's absolutely amazing that he even gets credit for the Bible.
Let's talk a little bit about ancient archaeology, Patrick. You've arrived at a lot of conclusions regarding where mankind comes from, how we develop, what we are about, the point of our existence. Could you start giving us a little bit of information about ancient archaeology and how it points to the direction of mankind?
Well, the origins of mankind, I presume you're talking about. Throughout the planet, all over the planet, you are going to find megalithic and monolithic structures. The most common form is pyramids. People know about the Great Pyramids in Egypt, the pyramids in South America. But all over Europe, you have dolmen, which are basically, they consider them burial. A megalithic structure is a structure made out of huge stones, monolithic stones, which are huge stones, usually tons and tons or more. And we find these structures all over the planet. They are absolutely precise in their engineering. They're wonders of construction. The Great Pyramid of Egypt is a fascinating study in itself. It's the largest structure in the world, and up until the Empire State Building was built, it was the tallest building in the world. And it's perfectly aligned to true north. It's perfectly level over 13 acres. It's got 2.5 million stones that were cut to precision measurements and hauled as far as 600 miles to the Giza Plateau.
I've heard, Patrick, that we would not be able to duplicate that today, even with our modern technology. Is that true, or is that a myth?
It's not only true that we could not build it, we cannot destroy it. Somebody was actually given a contract by Parsons Engineering back in the 80s to come up with a plan for taking the pyramid apart, because the philanthropist had decided that he figured, okay, well, let's see if they can figure out how to take it apart. Then maybe they can figure out how to put it together. But it could absolutely not be built by our current technological standards. And there are some very strange aspects to that pyramid. Most people don't realize that those stones are glued together with an adhesive. They're purposely cut back 1/50th of an inch to leave a gap of 1/50th of an inch between the stones. And between those stones is an adhesive that is so strong, it is held ever since it was built, thousands and thousands of years. And that adhesive was made from substances that do not match any of the 65,000 known substances on this planet. Absolutely fascinating the way it's built, the way it's constructed. It's a marvel of engineering. We have on the website, we have a section called the Giza Oracle. And everything is on the main page of the website, BibleUFO.com. And you can scroll down and you can find the Giza Oracle. And it's absolutely fascinating, the facts that are concerned with that. But that's only one of hundreds and thousands of structures around the planet. Egypt has over 100 pyramids. The Sudan has over 100 pyramids. They are constantly discovering. They just discovered a whole complex in Peru that's absolutely fascinating.
All right, and Patrick, one of the things that I don't understand, and maybe you can clear this up, we keep finding pyramids, and as a matter of fact, I sent you a find on Bosnia.
That and was yet, fascinating, when you look at, yes.
Okay, when you look at the picture, or at least when I look at the picture, what I see, I certainly see something that looks like a pyramid, but it's dirt. I mean, it's all dirt covered. Is there an expectation that there are stones or rocks under there?
I'm sure there would be. I believe they mentioned that they did dig into it and they have found stones. A lot of the pyramids, now we're used to the concept like the Great Pyramid. Some of these pyramids are actually earth filled and there's stones around them. But over the years, what you have to realize depending on the age of these pyramids, if there was a flood, as a, for instance, a number of these things could have been covered over, and we see a lot of them that have been buried. But yes, there's a very good possibility, in a lot of cases, hills have turned out to be some fascinating things underneath those hills. And it's very hard to tell, but usually excavation, if you're excavating, they usually find it.
Okay, so, in simple terms that the common man could understand, what is the point of the pyramids?
Well, we're not sure exactly what the point is. They were used for a purpose. We don't know what the purpose was, and the complexes that surrounded them, we're not sure what their purpose was, but we do know that by the way they were constructed, by the preciseness of the way the stones are cut, by the incredible weight that had to be moved, that whoever built those pyramids did not come from this planet. There's absolutely no question about it. They didn't have the technology. At the time that these pyramids were built, the only tools they had were copper. And I'm a carpenter by trade, and I guarantee you, I don't even have any copper tools for cutting wood, let alone granite and other hard stones, which are almost impossible to deal with even in our modern age.
Yeah, what amazes me, Patrick, is how the archaeologists of today, traditional archaeology, can with a straight face, tell people that the Egyptians built these things with copper implements. How did they do that? I mean, how did they actually get away with that kind of absurdity?
Well, science has a tendency to be that way. They make these profound statements and make them almost seem factual, but in truth, they have no basis in fact. You have to understand that in academia, what you learn in a university, and usually you learn from professors who were taught by professors and it just follows on down the line. And one of the most important realizations is that if they get it wrong the first time and they keep teaching it, it's going to stay wrong until somebody corrects it. Now, But changing archaeology, I mean, it's as deep and dark a thing as it appears, as the concept appears, and they are stuck in the primitive age and they can't seem to get out of it. It's absolutely amazing that they ignore the realities that we're talking about here, that no construction. There have been a bunch of contractors that have gone over to Egypt and say, and every one of them, to a man, will say, no, we can't do this. Nobody could build this. And yet, science or academia ignores it, but they ignore a lot of other things.
And even the Egyptians themselves, Egypt, the archaeologists there in the museum still try to insist that this was built by people using copper implements. Now, Patrick, It brings to mind, at least to my mind, that there is a controlling part of all this that we're not discussing yet, and I want to jump right into it. And folks, this may seem a bit of a huge jump, but I think it's really important. Patrick, what I want you to discuss is the Santa Clara decision of 1886. Now, folks, this decision has a lot to do with what's been going on in our world and who's controlling it and who keeps fostering, you know, onto us these ridiculous concepts. Patrick, why don't you address this issue a little bit?
Well, the Santa Clara decision, as it's called, was a case in Santa Clara County, California. It was Santa Clara County versus the Southern Pacific Railroad Company. And what it did, it was a case concerning right-of-way and fences, surprisingly or not. Now, it's very, very complicated how this all came to be and what anybody in the audience that wants to study it can go to the to Google and type in Santa Clara decision, or there's a great website called the Santa Clara Blues, and all you have to do is look up Santa Clara Blues and you'll find it. But basically what we're talking about here is the 14th Amendment to the Constitution of the United States. What happened was it was not actually, the decision was actually not rendered by the court at that time. It was a ruling about the decision afterwards. And like I say, it's very complicated. You'll have to study to understand. But it's concerning the 14th Amendment. Now, the choice of the word person, when we're talking about what we're talking about here is corporate personhood, that the corporations of the United States and of the rest of the world actually have an identity in the courts called corporate personhood. Now, the word person arises from the way the 14th Amendment to the Constitution, which was passed in 1868, was worded, and from an earlier legal usage of the word person. Now, let me read the 14th Amendment to the Constitution, Section 1. All persons born or naturalized in the United States and subject to the jurisdiction thereof are citizens of the United States and the states wherein they reside. No state shall make or enforce any law which shall abridge the privileges or immunities of citizens of the United States, nor shall any state deprive any person of life, liberty, or property with due process of law, nor deny any person within its jurisdiction the equal protection of laws. Now, let me sum this up real quick. Corporate personhood is bad. When you give it to a corporation, it's bad because it is the basis of the corporations being regarded by the Supreme Court with other rights, such as equal protection under the law along with a human being, free speech, the right to free speech, and the right to remain silent in criminal cases, and protection from searches. These are the rights that we have as a citizen, of the United States, and most people do not realize that corporations have exactly the same rights that we do. But there's one serious problem about that. Corporations were originally set up to shield a group of investors from liability. So what you've got is you've got a name standing there, and all of the people behind that name are protected by corporate law. Now, if that name has an identity and can function as a person with no legal liability whatsoever, in other words, you can't put a corporation in jail. You can't do the kind of things with a corporation that you can with a person. So that's one of the problems that we have now. If anybody's interested in studying corporate personhood, that's what they need to do, is just go to Google and type in corporate personhood. We do have this detailed on the website, on the front page, under the section called Humanity Incorporated. And we outlaw how this all happened.
I, folks, I'm bringing this up because it's the corporations across the planet that have a lot to do with what you learn and the kind of information that you get. And a lot of information is being suppressed by corporations. There is a website called gangsofamerica.com, and if you want to read about the Santa Clara decision and corporations and how they control you and what you think you know, that's one place to go. The whole concept, Patrick, of a corporation having the same rights as an individual, I mean, it, of course, it's ludicrous, but that's what's going on. I would guess that over time, the powers that be, stemming all the way back to the pharaohs, were doing something similar. In other words, information is being manipulated by large groups of people, and maybe in some cases small groups of people, and we've gotten to a point where, like you had said earlier in the show, something is handed down, and it's handed down over and over again, and pretty soon we start believing it. And of course, as it comes out of a corporation, it must be real.
Absolutely. Let me read you a quote real quick. What most of us are fighting for is to break up this very partnership between big business and government, which is where we have the problem. When big business begins to control government, then that's when we've got a problem. We call upon all intelligent men to bear witness to that if this plan were consummated, the great employers and capitalists of the country would be under a more overpowering temptation to take control of the government and keep it subservient to their purpose. That's a quote from Woodrow Wilson in 1913. Now, this has been a steady fight throughout the history of this country. A lot of people don't realize that if you go all the way back to the Boston Tea Party, the Boston Tea Party was actually activated by an argument between the tea growers of the United States, of which, surprisingly enough, at that time, there were about 10,000 tea growers, and the Far East India Trading Company tried to dump tea on, the taxation without representation issue was interesting, but what it was England was allowing the Far East India Trading Company to send great quantities of tea from Ceylon to Boston, and they were going to try to undercut the market of all of the people in the United States, the tea merchants. Our revolution in this country was based on a fight against a corporation. It's absolutely fascinating. We've been fighting this since 1776. It's
and the battle continues today.
Yes,
Patrick, we are starting to run out of time here. I want to jump back now into the Bible itself and see if we can't at least cover a few points before we get to the end of this hour. You mentioned on your website that the Bible identifies the source of all evil as the obsession with wealth. Is that where corporations come in?
Well, the identification of that says that in 1 Timothy 6:10 it says, "For the love of money is the root of all evil." The word love comes from the word avarice. Now, what we have, the whole concept of corporations controlling the wealth that they do, what the Bible specifically states, if you look at all the teachings of Christ, wealth is an anathema to the concept of Christianity. When he was asked what you can do to enter the kingdom of heaven by a rich man, he said, "Sell what you have, give it to the poor." His whole ministry was about putting people loving one another. He made that clear. But when you see, if you look at the history of the world and you see what's been going on in the world, you'll see that wherever we have a problem, it's always related to money, possession, mineral wealth. What we have going on in Iraq right now with the oil problem that we have in this country with this incredible consumption of oil, it all breaks down to greed, the love of money. And we're the little people on the short end of the stick. We're the ones that are, while the gap is widening between the rich and the poor, and this is what the Bible spoke of, that the rich and powerful will eventually control the world. And what we see it coming, the clearest prophecy in the Bible is about the mark of the beast. And it says the mark of the beast is very, very clearly defined. Let me read the verse here real quick. Let's see. "And he causeth all, both small and great, rich and poor, free and bond, to receive a mark in their right hand and in their forehead." Now, everybody knows that as being the mark of the beast. It's the 17th verse, which immediately follows this, that most people don't pay any attention to. "And that no man might buy or sell, say if he had the mark or the name of the beast or the number of his name. There's no question that if you look at this and read it carefully and slowly, you'll see that what this is talking about is global control of finances. Everybody worries
corporate
about
power. You're talking about corporate power again.
We believe that's what it is. Now, when you're talking about control of finances that you can't buy, who are you buying and selling from? The corporations control, it's more and more as we see it, it's happening rapidly. More and more larger corporations are replacing smaller ones. So if you're talking about global exchange around the world, which is what we're headed for now with all the free trade policies, what this will do, what this market says it will do is that you will not be able to buy or sell, in other words, any financial transactions that you have, unless you have an identifying mark on your hand or on your forehead.
Now, wait a minute, Patrick. In the Bible, it actually comes up with a number, 666. Is that what you're referring to?
Well, the number 666 is, we don't really relate that to the actual mark itself. The mark is the number of a name. We don't believe that it's going to be like a tattoo 666 or what have you. We're not exactly sure what the significance of that mark is. As a matter of fact, it says, here is wisdom, for those that have wisdom. In other words, it's pretty well hidden, and we don't know exactly where the 666 comes from. The most important thing that we're concerned about, see, we don't, whatever the detail is about it, we know one thing specifically, that you will have something on your hand that you will have to have it on your hand in order to buy or sell. Now, these implantable chips that Verichip Corporation is putting out right now, if anybody wants to check on that, all they have to do is type in Verichip, V-I-R-C-H-I-P, and you're going to find out about radio frequency identification. And, of course, RFID is the common term for that. And everybody, you know, that's a hot topic right now for conspiracy theorists and things like that. But what we're looking for is some kind of mark that will control finances. And, with the security from the terrorist threat, ID theft and things like that, and very, very quickly, but we're becoming a cashless society. I personally don't use a terribly a great quantity of cash for my major purchases. It's just too simple to use plastic.
There's no question about it, Patrick.
We're not.
It's not that we're becoming a cashless society. We are a cashless society.
Right.
Every day
we can easily convert.
I mean, I go into Walmart just about every day to do some shopping because we live right across the street from one. And I buy all my purchases on my credit card, or actually it's a debit card, and everyone else is doing exactly the same thing. It's just easier to deal with. Is it possible that it's the credit card that is being referred to in the Bible?
No, I don't believe so, because it states very clearly that it's receive a mark in their right hand or in their forehead. It's specific to that.
Could the forehead be referring to retina identification?
I don't know. I find that rather strange, but this could have something to do with the fact that possibly they use that as a verification, perhaps. I don't know exactly what the forehead concept is, but. What these implantable chips are now, they're getting very popular. They actually have what's called a chipmobile going around injecting people. They have sold enough of these implantable chips to the U.S. government to outfit the entire, U.S. military. And, the whole concept of the Mark of the Beast, we believe, let me give you a quote here from Verichip, itself. Verichip is a miniaturized implantable radio frequency identification device that has the potential to be used in a variety of security, financial, and other applications. This information is available on their website, Verichip. about the size of a grain of rice, each VeriChip product contains a unique verification number and will be available in several formats. The verification number is captured by briefly passing a proprietary scanner over the VeriChip. A small amount of radio frequency energy passes from the scanner, energizing the document, then emits a radio frequency signal transmitting the verification number. Now, what they're talking about here, in the financial area, the company sees enormous untapped potential for VeriChip as a personal verification technology that could help to curb identity theft and prevent fraudulent access to banking, especially via ATMs and credit card accounts. VeriChip is tamper-proof. So you see where they're going with this.
Well, yeah. Well, what's amazing to me is I think that people will actually flock to get those things. People will more than willingly give up their being anonymous and have that chip implanted with a number in it. They've become the number, and they'll do it very willingly.
Unfortunately, I have a tendency to agree with you, Nevin. That's the scary part. Because it could not be plainer. It could not be plainer. Without it, you kill yourself.
Patrick, I'm gonna. I think we ought to open a call in line and let's see if anyone is out there. I just notified Don to go ahead, and if people want to call in, let's do it now, folks. We don't have that much left of the hour. Go ahead, Patrick.
Well, basically, what we're saying is that an interesting thing about that. Hold on just a second. Let me find this. The concept of the chip, as it relates to corporations, is contained in Revelations just before this. Let me get that real quick. Okay, now the verse that I just read to you is in Revelations 13:16. Now, that is preceded by the verse 11 starts with the explanation of a beast coming out of the earth. And what it says, he does great wonders so that he makes fire come down from heaven on the earth in the sight of men and deceiveth them that dwell on the earth by the means. Now, I want to point out that wherever you see the word he or him or his or anything in this verse or generally in this entire chapter, that was added by the translators. He is not in there. It can be it. It's a generic word that can mean anything. So what it says is, he doeth great wonders, he make fire come down from heaven in the sight of man, and deceiveth them that dwell on the earth by the means of those miracles which he had the power to do in the sight of the beast. And he had the power to give life unto the image of the beast, that the image of the beast should both speak and cause as many as would not worship the image of the beast should be killed. We believe that the Santa Clara decision may be a fulfillment of that prophecy. Because the first thing that this image does is says that he caused all men, both small and great, rich and poor, to receive a mark in their right hand. That's the very first thing this image does. Now, could the image be corporation? Could if there is an evil power on this planet, what if that evil power doesn't have some dark den somewhere, but is actually operating out full, controlling the human race with the most powerful motivation, greed, and using that to control people, and then the way they're going to control humanity. We're not talking about a government here, and as a matter of fact, you will not see a government structure mentioned anywhere in Revelations as controlling the planet. Nobody ever resists any kind of government. There's no world government. It's basically what it's talking about here is whatever this image was. It was given life, and it immediately causes a global financial control.
Patrick, what I want you to bring into this is, where in all of this, between archaeology, the corporations, the Santa Clara decision, where do UFOs fit into all this? How do UFOs relate to all this information?
Well, the important thing is that my website is called The Bible UFO Connection, and that's basically the start of it. What we have done is we have compiled 1,200 verses that show various aspects of what appear to be craft in the Bible. They're broken down into four basic categories. The vehicles themselves, for instance, clouds. I'll just give you a quick example here. In the Old and New Testament, the God of the the Lord Jehovah of the Old Testament and the Lord Jesus of the New Testament, who became, a lot of people don't realize that the God of the Old Testament became Jesus of the New Testament. Now, he is described as flying in thick clouds, swift clouds, bright clouds, dark clouds, white clouds, low clouds, great clouds, fiery clouds. And there are platforms, vessels, whirling chariots of fire, sky thrones, fiery horses, cherubims, thick darknesses, great fire, whirling winds, fiery wheels, pavilions, dark waters, storms, sky dwellings, rolls, and sanctuaries. Now, all of these are in the sky. Now, one of the important things that we discovered, and this was the key to how this research ever came about, we were looking for flight in the Bible to see what we could find. And we started looking up the word skies to see what was flying in the skies. And we only found the word a dozen times throughout the 700,000 words in the Bible, 770,000 words in the Bible, and all of this occurring outside, the word sky only appeared 11 times. But the word heaven appears 700 times in the Bible, and wherever you see all this activity, you'll see it in heaven. That's the most common thing. If you look at the word heaven, where it appears, with the exception of the 700 times it appears, with the exception of two times, it is literally relating to the sky.
You're saying that the word heaven is often meant to be the sky?
It is always meant to be the sky in the Bible. It was the old English word for the sky in the court of King James and the court of England. It was generally meant to be, it was always meant to be the sky. When you looked up, when you opened your window and you didn't say the sky was blue, you'd say the heavens are blue. And if you look at this, if you look at all the places where heaven appears, you'll see very few things. If you just take the word heaven and replace it with sky, and I detail this right on the main page, I've got a link to Heaven is the Sky. It is not a divine retirement home that you go to. It's the place where the birds are, and the place where the stars are, and these strange craft that are in the Bible.
These strange craft.
Right. Well, what appear to be the other thing is that not only are these vehicles described, but their flight patterns are described, and we have those flight characteristics broken down to in flight. These things are describing as flying in heaven or flying in the sky. They ascend down to the earth. These clouds and chariots and pavilions and platforms ascend down to the earth, or descend down to the earth. They ascend into the sky and they hover for long periods of time. A classic example of this is the pillar of fire that we all know about in the Exodus. Now, this pillar led over a million people. A lot of people don't realize it, but when Moses took the Hebrews out of Egypt, he took over a million people, and he took a number of Egyptians with him. So you're talking a million people going through the wilderness for 40 years, and this fiery pillar, and it was a fiery pillar at night, and it was a pillar of a cloud during the day. The word pillar comes from the word taub, which means can either mean a column or the base of a column. So we may be talking, it may be actually relating to a platform of fire and a platform of a cloud, and it led them through the desert, ascending through the wilderness, ascending. When it wanted them to move, it would ascend into the sky, and it would move along, and then it would stop, and that's where the nation of Israel would simply follow it.
Okay, so you're talking about a classic UFO, is what you're saying.
What appears to be a classic UFO. They ascend, they hover for long periods of time, for months during the Exodus. It speaks of them hovering for long periods of time.
Why are aliens, things, entities, and UFOs, why are they here? Are we so interesting?
Well, that's where we differ from most people's concept. We do not believe in aliens or extraterrestrials. What most people believe, especially when you consider von Däniken's work, which is the first one to come out with this, with Chariots of the Gods back in 1965, 54 millions of his copies of his book have been sold. So everybody knows about that concept. Most people would consider my concept as being that the aliens have been mistaken for the gods. We do not believe that, Nevin. What we believe is that the gods have been mistaken for aliens. In other words, these are not aliens that we're seeing. We believe that these beings actually terraformed this planet. They are not visitors here. They terraformed the planet, what we call the creation in the beginning. You'll notice that the planet was here. And talks about a darkness on the face of the earth, and then all of these things begin to happen, and then you see all these things being created. Well, if you try to turn this into a science fiction movie, it would be terraforming, and a lot of the things. But these are technologically advanced is a very it's about the only way that we can say it. But these
You're using the word gods, a plurality. So you're obviously talking about more than one power.
Okay. If you look into the very first verse of the Bible, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. The word God comes from the word Elohim. Now, in the Hebrew, whenever you see an IYM added to the end of the word, it's the same thing as in English, adding an S. It makes it plural.
Oh.
Elohim is a plural word, and if you look at it, we use Strong's Exhaustive Concordance. It's the easiest and fastest and most reliable way to find out what the original words are, and any Hebrew dictionary will show this. The word God is plural. The individual God that we see in the Bible, you'll always see it prefaced by the word Lord God. Now, the word Lord comes from the word Jehovah. So when you see the God of Israel, the God that talked to Moses, the God of Abraham, the God that did all of this individual God that everybody worshiped, that was the Lord God or Jehovah, the Elohim. The word God is plural, even when it's used with Lord God. The word God is plural, and so what you're talking about is Jehovah, one of the Elohim. So, and that's why we use the word God. The Bible is not monotheistic. It is definitely polytheistic. If you just look
and
at
yet,
the time,
that's what we've been indoctrinated to the monotheistic platform. I mean, as a child, that's what I was indoctrinated with. That's what you were indoctrinated with. And the churches clearly state that that's what separates, quote, organized Christian religion from paganism. And yet, they, in fact, are talking about polytheism, not monotheism.
Yes. Yeah, it's absolutely fascinating. It's simply the translation, the way it was translated by the translators. They knew the word was, you see, the thing is that there were 54 translators working on this for a period of 4 years. They were directed by the Bishop of London, and they had a strict dogmatic concept in mind. So monotheism was the order of the day. That's what it was. But if you would go back to Jesus' time, they wouldn't be saying God. They'd be talking about the gods, because the word is plural. It's definitely plural. The if you look at it very simply, there's God the Father and God the Son, right?
Oh, like,
we know that.
We're going to
from the Bible, so that's definitely plural right there.
We're going to have to wrap this up in a little bit, but before we do, I want you to get into an explanation of who Jesus Christ was. Was he as he's represented in the Bible, or is he in fact part of this group Godhead that you're talking about?
Well, if you look at the first chapter of Mark, it talks about the Word, and anybody who is not aware, now this is not something that's commonly taught in the church, the Jehovah that I spoke of, the national God of Israel, the God of Moses, became Jesus Christ. He is clearly identified in Mark as the Creator. Reading the entire first chapter, it is very easy to see how he's talking about, in the beginning was the Word was God, and the Word was with God, and all things were made by him, and he, and as the chapter progresses, it says, and he became flesh and dwelt with us, and we know him as the Son of God, Jesus Christ. Jesus Christ of the New Testament was Jehovah of the Old Testament. When we see him again in John, in the revelation of John, the revelation to John, we once again see him as Jehovah the Elohim. And he's clearly described, John actually sees him.
So are in fact saying that Jesus is in fact God.
He is a God. He is the immediate, the way it's described is he is the eldest son of the family of Elohim.
You make one more statement, and we're probably going to end this program in a minute here, but the statement is that Jesus states that humans, in fact, are gods. What do you mean by that?
He was approached. He was approached in during his ministry, and they asked him who he was, and he said, "I, Father, are one." And what he did at that point was he committed blasphemy according to the rules of the church, of the Jewish law. He had blasphemed himself, and they picked up stones to stone him. And he said, "Many good things have I done in your presence. For which of these things do you stone me?" And they said, "Not for any sins, because you equate yourself with God." And Jesus said, "Is it not written in your law that I have said you are God?" Now, we've torn that verse apart completely. It literally means you are God. He is quoting Psalms, which he spoke as Jehovah, when he said, "Is it not written in your law that I have said?" Well, their law contained the Psalms. He said, the books of the law contain the Psalms, and he said, "Is it not written in your law that I have said you are gods?" And you look in Psalms and it says, "The Lord God said, you are God." What it basically, and if you look in the Old Testament, if you look in Genesis and you find, how did God create man? He created man in his own image and after his likeness.
Are you saying then that all humans have the same divinity as the man Jesus?
What we're talking about, the gospel of Jesus, when he talks about the gospel, you hear about the adoption, you hear about brothers and sisters, you hear about brethren. It is a big family thing, and basically what it says is that you will become a member of the family of God, Elohim, God, this God family. What we believe is that the planet is just one big nursery for the Elohim. It appears to be that way.
We are, I know I keep saying we're running out of time, but you know, Patrick, you got me absolutely fascinated. I want to cover one more little thing, and that is the alien presence is here
should we be in fear of this or not?
Absolutely not. We've been seeing this. I have 2,000 sightings recorded on my website. Not one of them has any negative things to it. And this is throughout history, long before Jesus and long before the books of the Bible were written. There are records of this. If you look at what we see happening, we don't see any aggression from these. Now, there's a big thing about abductions. That's a question that needs to be addressed. We're not sure of the validity of it. We do believe that people are abducted, but we are very, very, we're highly questionable about evil abductions, about obtrusive abductions, about any kind of abduction of, if at all, is going to be traumatic to a human being. But we don't.
Well, at the very beginning of this show, I talked about the tornadoes, tsunamis, so on and so forth. There are a lot of people on this planet, and probably part of the audience right now, who believe that mega Earth changes are about to take place. Is this something that you also believe from your research in the Bible?
Well, of course, Nevin, throughout history, ever since Jesus died and made these prophecies, every generation, I guarantee you, every one of us, they thought, the apostles thought, they were the ones that were going to see the end of the world. And I'm sure every generation after that, and you see this, you know, you can follow the history of it. People are always calling that this is the time when we can't tell for sure, but I guarantee you, if you look at what's going on in the world right now in this massive global financial system that's developing, which we see prophesied in the Bible, when you start seeing, there's a number of things besides earthquakes in deep places and famines in the world and wars and rumors of wars. There's also religious strife. There's also a waning of love for people for one another. There's a number of different prophecies. As a matter of fact, we're fixing to put a whole section up on what the end times will be like according to what the Bible says. And we try very hard not to add anything more. We certainly do commentary where we feel it's necessary to explain what a verse is, but we generally let the verses speak for themselves.
Wait a minute, Patrick. I'm not quite satisfied with that. I want it at a personal level.
I think we're close. I think we're very close. From a personal level, yes. I believe we're close. All the signs are pointing toward it. The scary number, Nevin, is 2012. We have so many societies coming up with that number. The Mayans had it. The Egyptians had it. The Mayan calendar goes back 11,000 years, and then goes all the way up to December the 22nd, I believe, 2012, and stops dead in the road.
So, well, we're all kind of holding our breath right now, I think, with all the major disasters going on and the dates that were presented. Patrick, it has been an absolutely fascinating evening. Can we get you back again?
Certainly, and it's been a pleasure talking to you. I'm sorry we didn't have more time than we did.
Oh, you know, Patrick, the same thing happens to me every Sunday night. I just run out of time. But I got to tell you, Patrick, you've got me absolutely fascinated. And I probably will do a little bit of extra work myself in searching out those pyramids. So, Patrick, I want to thank you for your time, for being our guest on our show tonight. And believe me, it is very, very much appreciated. Thank you so much.
Thank you. It has been a pleasure talking to you.
And that ends our show for tonight. Again, it was a fascinating journey into the realms of forbidden knowledge. Until next time, this is Nevin Campanella, wishing all of you health, happiness, and a safe journey on your chosen path. Good night.
You have been listening to BBS Radio, a blogandservice.com production and a service to others endeavor. Thank you very much for tuning into our radio program. And we wish you much peace and joy on your journey.